Welcome to Church in the North, a podcast by ministry leaders and for ministry leaders. I'm your host, Rob Chartrand, program coordinator for Christian ministry at Briarcrest College, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jeff Dresser, assistant professor of worship arts. Welcome, Jeff.
Hey, Rob.
And Dan Goddard, lead pastor of Victory Church. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Rob.
Well, hey, it's good to be back in the studio with you guys today. Hey, I went to a conference last week. I think I shared that on last week's podcast. And you know, one of the things that surprised me is that there were so many people who came up to me and said, hey, I listened to your podcast and I like your podcast.
Cool.
Yeah, it was awesome to get the feedback. And, you know, they were sharing what they really appreciated about the podcast was the variety of different guests that we have on it, and the number of different churches, different types of churches, different, you know, backgrounds in ministry, and et cetera. And one of the things I said to them is, I said, hey, you know what? I know you like the podcast. You know what would be really helpful for us to get the word out about the podcast? Like us and subscribe and give us some reviews. Those would be really, really helpful for us. So, I think that would be something, I don't know, what do you guys think would be important for our listeners today to do? How could they do that? Anyone, any of you guys got any idea how people can help get the word out for our podcast?
Well, I mean, whatever platform you're listening on, usually there is a rating button close to the close to the podcast, and a button that says review. And so the five star reviews are especially helpful.
We love those. Mm-hmm.
And they help other people who are looking for a podcast like this to find it. And the way the almighty algorithms work, it really helps us if we can get those subscriptions, likes, and those five star reviews. So
that's right. And it's not about us. It's not about our own sense of self worth and value.
It's not just like me.
That's
like
right. We get that in Jesus. We don't need it in our podcast.
It doesn't hurt though. I just want to be very clear. It does not hurt. So
you know, it would be great if we also heard from our listeners, maybe if they had some, I don't know, like some suggestions or whatnot.
Yeah, suggestions, questions that they'd like us to talk about, topic questions, or even guest suggestions.
Yeah. I've had a few of those. Those have been great. Yeah.
Awesome.
How do they do that, Dan?
Well, they would have to email us, right?
Yes.
At our email address, which is podcast at, what is it?
Briarcrest.ca.
Podcast at briarcrest.ca.
Yeah. So, and I've had a few people reach out with some ideas about guests for the show. And so we certainly appreciate it. So for our listeners, please subscribe, like us, give us a rating, and share it with your friends.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this week on the podcast, it's going to be part two of a two-part interview we've had with David Goretzky, and he's the president and CEO of the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada. And this week's topic is going to be, you know, a really somber conversation, a serious topic, because we're going to be talking we're going to be talking about medical assistance and dying, and we know that's something that's deeply impactful for our Canadian context, as well as maybe for some of our congregations. So, guys, you know, we've had a chance to all listen to that part of the podcast in advance, so we know what's coming. But I just have to ask you, how has MAID maybe impacted you or your own congregation?
Yeah, well, honestly, I never thought it would. Mm-hmm. I mean, we live in Moose Jaw, far from, you know, whatever. I just thought, oh, that's probably a rare story in Toronto.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have had instances, right, in connected to our church. So we had one couple in our church message me as a pastor and just say, hey, we're distraught, close friends of ours that we've been friends with for decades. One of them has decided that this is how they're going to end their life. Mm. And they were just like, how do we relate to them? How do we tell them that we don't think that's a good idea? How do we share the gospel with them? They just were looking for advice and even saying, like, if they were open, would you be willing to visit with them as a pastor and so on? Of course, I said absolutely, and just gave them little bits and pieces of advice through it. And there wasn't any response back. But then, you know, ultimately, I did have to pastor this couple through the journey, because that person did end up ending their life through MAID, and it was their friend. And so you're checking in on them, how you doing, that kind of thing. So it has come close to home. And then there was one other case, actually, where a gal in our church called one of our other pastors. She lives in a senior's home, and she called distraught that her friend had just passed away through assisted, I guess, medical assisted, whatever they call that. And she actually had just led her friend through the sinner's prayer because her friend knew that she was going to die this way. And she was just distraught, thinking, like, is she really going to heaven? Just all these questions people ask pastorally. And one of our pastors had to walk with her through that. So, so it does come closer to home than you might think.
Well, I think the issue of MAID is related to another issue we're facing culturally, which is that of mental health, suicidal ideation. And, you know, and so we they've just put a halt on that as a reason for MAID, which is the mental health thing, which, you know, I think we can be thankful for. But, you know, I hear stories of students all the time, that are in my context, and, a number of them just have these backstories of severe mental health challenges because of COVID. Some of them, you know, have wrestled with suicidal ideation and ideation. And so, you know, just the thought to me of giving permission to them to end their lives because of mental health is just, I just, it breaks me on the inside when I think about that. So, and I'm sure you've had people you've experienced in your own lives who've wrestled with suicide. And you know, as in my years of pastoring, there's been a number of people in my congregation who have taken their own lives. And then I think about the horror and the difficulty of that and how traumatic that was. And, but then to now be in a cultural moment where we're giving permission to do that, it's just, it's mind boggling, to me when I think about it. Jeff, any feedback on that?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that I just hate opening the door and telling people, sometimes life isn't worth living.
Right.
And I think just that is such a damaging thought to put into, you know, a young person's mind who might be, you know, struggling with suicide. But to have medical professionals sort of opening that door is frightening. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, I know with my own elderly family members who are, you know, having to go to the hospital and get treatment, it just makes, like, I am wondering about the kind of treatment that they're gonna get. It certainly undermined my trust in doctors in some of the stories that you hear. And I don't know if they're blown out of proportion, but but I mean, last week I saw a Babylon Bee video making fun of Canadian doctors for prescribing MAID for very minor ailments.
Right.
And ha ha ha, isn't this funny? But I mean, the fact that you know, the fact that an outlet like the Babylon Bee is making videos about this means that this is a big concern. There's an issue there.
When it's an American, you know, organization and they're looking north of the border and looking at us, sure.
And I think pastorally too, we have medical professionals in our churches, and we want Christ followers to be entering that profession and serving in that way. I mean, it's in many ways historically Christian profession, right? Just the moral dilemmas that our medical professionals will face and are facing in that whole journey, and it's a challenge pastoring our doctors and nurses through that journey and their own battles with how do they respond.
Any thoughts on how pastors might address this within their own churches?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I don't know a lot. It's one reason I'm thankful for EFC. They've done a lot of research on this and be a great resource for pastors and for leaders. And I know David Gretzky, that's a big part of his heart is resourcing. So
I think this is one thing we can't just take a step back and just be quiet about. It's something that is. In somehow we have to engage in culture, without it being partisan. I mean, it doesn't have to be partisan, right? Because, but the gospel is political, and but it's not partisan. But I mean, I think it's okay. It gives permission for followers of Jesus to speak their voice and to, you know, talk about it. And I think that's what EFC is doing. It's giving us that opportunity to do.
Man, to say we care.
Yeah.
Like we want to do good.
Yeah.
Right. There's
yeah.
people who are hurting. There's issues that are that people yeah. are battling with, and Christ followers. We care for those who are going through difficult
yeah.
things,
yeah.
and we want to step up for those who are vulnerable and in need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and certainly in the podcast, I don't want to give too much away, but I mean, there's probably more to us than just speaking up, more at stake than that, if we're going to truly be the people of God, you know, setting Christ's example in culture and being his image bearers in the world. So we'll get into that in the podcast. And so we're going to give you, our listeners, an opportunity to do that, to talk, to listen to Dr. David Goretzky and this next half of the conversation. Thanks for joining me, guys. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
You said that you have over 700 churches that are affiliates with you. Is that right?
So we have 48 denominations.
48 denominations.
Representing about 7,500 congregations.
Okay, 7,500 congregations.
And then we have about yeah. 600 or 700 additional congregations, some of whom would be part of denominations that yeah. are already affiliates. But there's a number of churches, like here in Cairnport. I believe Cairnport, the church in Cairnport yeah. here, is an EFC affiliate
okay.
because they're an independent congregation that
right.
don't have a denominational
right. yeah,
connection.
Yeah. So if your denomination is an affiliate, then by representation, all the other churches within it.
Not in a formal,
not
sort
in a formal
of
sense.
Way.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
yeah, but
yeah.
a lot of affiliate denominations, their churches wouldn't necessarily, you know, take out individual affiliation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. But some do.
Yeah.
Some do. They actually see the value of being, you know, part of something larger, national.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So all told, you know, we're talking probably about around 8,000 congregations across Canada, representative of especially those denominations.
Yeah. I remember years ago in 93, I worked for the Moose Jaw Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
And I was the assistant executive director, probably more technically assistant to the executive
okay, yeah,
director.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And one of my jobs was to sell chamber memberships to businesses.
Right, no,
so I went to
yeah,
a lot of different,
yeah.
And inevitably the question was, well, what value is there in me
yeah.
being a member of the Chamber of Commerce? So what value is there in being an affiliate with EFC?
Right. I think the value has to do exactly what, you know, some of the things that we are actually doing, the collaboration work,
yeah.
the advocacy work, research and equipping. But I think it also, it's not even so much like a, you know, buy a membership, these are your benefits. That's
yeah,
not
yeah.
kind of the approach. It's really more about association.
Hmm.
It's identifying your tribe.
Yeah.
It's identifying, you know, your family. But theologically, it really has to do with, I'm increasingly convinced that one of the shortfalls of evangelical ecclesiology is we're either very good at the local level or the global level.
Okay.
But all the levels in between we struggle with.
Hmm.
So what I mean by that is I say at a local level, you know, most churches have some kind of membership or, you know, some kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
membership.
And they
approach.
Struggle to get members.
And they struggle to get
yeah.
members. But at least by becoming a member of a local congregation, you're basically, you know, you're planting your flag and saying, here's my allegiance. This is who I'm going to support.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
who I identify with. Then theologically, evangelical ecclesiology says, we believe that the church, capital C church, is, you know, every believer in Jesus across time and space that
sure.
has ever existed
yeah, yeah.
and ever will exist. The problem with that, although that's theologically true,
sure.
I think that's a biblical
the universal
concept,
church.
The
yeah.
universal church, it has no visible recognizability.
Yeah, yeah.
It's easy to say I'm in a member or a part of some global level
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
But nobody can actually put their finger on it and say, well, who is that?
Right.
Who is that?
Yeah.
So what I've become much more convinced about is that evangelical ecclesiology really needs to heed much more its how, in what way is it actually visible as the church in our world?
Mm-hmm.
And if you just give me a second here on this. Back to Revelation. Like, yep. I'm again convinced that as we study the letters to the seven churches, for example, it's almost so blindingly obvious that we just blip right over it. But remember, none of these are individual congregations that Jesus
That's
is
right.
talking to.
Yeah.
He's talking to churches in cities.
Mm-hmm. And there could
right?
be many.
Yeah, there could be many.
Yeah.
That's right. So every address of the seven churches is to a geographical location.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are city-level yeah. geographies, right? In fact, I haven't reaffirmed this recently, but I remember teaching ecclesiology. I hear it at Briarcrest many times, and I should double-check this, but if you do a study of the word ecclesia in the New Testament, the word for church, you will find that the word church, ecclesia, is more often qualified by a geographical qualifier than any other qualifier in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that there's a high priority put on the visibility of the church.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so that's one thing. And so when Jesus is talking to the seven churches, he's talking to city churches.
Yeah.
Right?
Collectives.
Collectives, yeah.
yeah.
And I haven't forgotten your question.
Yeah. No, no.
The value yeah. of being associated with the EFC. So visibility in public witness of the church is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually am increasingly convinced of a couple theological convictions, very convinced that the success of the church in seeing the gospel go forward in our culture is proportionally related to how well we identify ourselves visibly and publicly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So when we retreat into our own, four church walls, there's a place for that. There's a place for the priestly, a service of worship mm-hmm. to God. But again, back to the book of Revelation, there's this twofold phrase that happens several times throughout the book of Revelation. He's elected us to become kingdom and priests. That,
right.
that couplet
right.
is six times in the book of Revelation, kingdom and priests. And so there's a governance side. And there's a liturgical or doxological side to
yeah.
the church. And the pendulum swing is the historically churches either have identified themselves visibly towards the kingdom side,
yeah.
the governance side,
yeah.
and
very
gotten ourselves but even gotten ourselves wrapped up in political ideologies and saying,
mm-hmm.
we are because we believe in this
yeah.
political ideology. Right,
yeah.
whether it's socialism or democracy or
monarchy,
yeah, yeah. any
nationalism.
One of those nationalism
yeah.
of any one of those types of things,
mm-hmm.
or the church flips over to the other side of the pendulum and says, "Oh, we're all about priestly work. We're all about worship,"
mm-hmm.
and then we become insular and isolated from and invisible to the public.
Right,
right.
right.
We're
yeah.
hidden away from the public. So it is fascinating to me, even in the book of Revelation, that the vision that God has for his people are to be kingdom and priests.
Yeah.
Kingdom and priests, which
yeah.
means there's both a public, visible identification of who we are in the public. We are an alternate kingdom. We're
mm-hmm.
an alternate polis. And on the other side, we are people who do draw in, and we do worship God, and we are identified by the one to whom we have ultimate allegiance and worship.
Yeah.
So back to why part of the EFC? I think that the importance of the evangelical church making an awareness, a public kind of visibility about who we are will have a significant effect upon our ability to speak into the cultural issues that we're facing in our day.
We're better together.
We're better together.
Yeah.
And one more thing from Revelation, because I'm really on Revelation recently.
Good. We need the theological foundation.
Yep.
Here we go.
The phrase, in chapter 5, Revelation 5, it comes in various variations, these four terms: every tribe, every nation, every people, every language.
Mm-hmm.
And it's seven times in the book of Revelation, that fourfold repetition. And when you think about those four terms, those are in many respects kind of visible representations of the people of God. Mm. And God's vision for the people of God is that we would be visibly identifiable as this global mosaic, global, national, regional, city mosaics, where a multiplicity of cultures, a multiplicity of languages, a multiplicity of ethnicities, a multiplicity of, of tribal people groups come together in harmony under the gospel and under the lordship of Christ. And that's the visible presence of the church in our world. And as long as we're, you know, isolating ourselves, even within our own denominational tribes, or even within our own, like, sort of regional, there's a multi-layered effect that happens if there's a public visibility in a region or in a city of churches working together and visibly identifying with one another. And you step that up all the way to the national. So the long answer is the visible representation of the church in Canada. If I can stand up and say, not only does the EFC represent an association of 48 denominations, which is wonderful. Someday I'd like to be able to say, 60, 70, 80 denominations, perhaps. But if I were also able to say, but that also represents X number of congregations across the nation, and that represents X number of ethnicities, and that represents X number of language groups. Suddenly, the visibility of the church is very difficult just to say, they're just a bunch of, isolated, insular people. It actually represents the global mosaic of the people of God.
Right. Clearly in the first century, the church was a movement that transcended even cities. Rome wouldn't persecute them if they weren't. It's happening all over Rome. And so they became this sect of the Messiah, Jesus, in Judaism.
And yet when you read the book of Acts, it is interesting, isn't it, how the book of Acts, the movement itself moved city by city.
It did, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's sort of the city-by-city narrative that goes on, right? And the apostles enter into a city, and they establish the ministry at the city level. I'm really, really hopeful and praying. I'm certainly seeing movements of this. I'm calling it ministerial 2.0.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is something I've recently just been thinking about, and I'm hoping it's going to resonate, and that is, I think that sometimes ministerial level, like citywide ministerial level, have been formed with certain goals in mind, like fellowship and mutual encouragement. And I'm not saying those are unworthy goals.
Yeah.
But I think they're the wrong reasons for a ministerial to form, right? Rather, I would think that encouragement, mutual equipping, those types of things are byproducts, natural outworkings, byproducts of when a citywide movement of churches, especially evangelical churches concerned about the gospel, are working together to say, okay, what are the city issues? What are the visible city issues that are pertinent to our community and to our city? And how are we as churches going to step up and actually, strategize?
Yeah.
Band together and try to address these things for the sake of the common good, for the sake of the gospel. Then all the byproducts of mutual encouragement and excitement and exhortation, they'll happen, but it'll be because we're on common mission.
Right.
We're on common mission. So I'm really kind of looking to this new ministerial, which is actually really a mission-oriented or gospel-oriented ministerial.
Right.
Focusing in on the needs of the city and the unique demographics and the unique challenges that every city is. The very best people to address the issues of the city in which we live are the people who live there.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? It's... in larger centers, larger cities, because I've pastored in the GTA, and I've pastored in Edmonton, and then I'm going to pastor in Moose Jaw and Regina. I find the smaller cities, it's I think it's easier for them to do the ministerial thing, but in the larger context, it's more challenging. Part of it is you have some big mega churches as well, and it's hard for, if you're on the team of a mega church, to show up to a ministerial without feeling the weight and feeling like you're, you know. So it's, I don't know, it's just challenging. But I won't go down that road. I just know. Yeah. But what is happening is, the youth ministries right now in cities are getting together. So like in Edmonton, there's like what's called the 780, and it's all the youth groups. They get together very, very well and worship together. Or it's Calgary, it's the 403. It's based on their postal code, basically, or their area code. Yep. So, but there is, you know, it is churches aren't doing the ministerial thing as much anymore. I know in Moose Jaw they're doing it. I know they have a great ministerial. So it is harder to get churches together. But one of your events gives them a reason perhaps to gather.
Yeah. So we've been doing, for example, we've been doing some regional citywide prayer events.
Yeah.
We're trying not to see the prayer event as an end unto itself, but as kind of a means to greater outcomes. Catalyst. And I mean, we'd be failing if we didn't say, like, standing behind renewal and revitalization of the church historically, like we can count on one finger and less how many times those renewals have come with prayer
preceding it.
Like it just seems to be the historical precedent, surprise, that renewal is almost always. And I can't imagine that there's an exception. Maybe there is.
It began in prayer.
Began in prayer.
That's right.
Began in prayer.
All the great revivals.
So even if at citywide levels, churches recognize that centrality, we don't have to agree with one another on every doctrinal point. That's why we have different denominations. Mm. We do have different denominational or the doctrinal types of points. But if we can agree on the common lordship of Jesus, there's only one Lord, and there's only one body, and there's only one faith. But come together and say, well, let's pray for our city.
Yeah.
Let's pray for an outpouring of the Holy Spirit into our city. That's where it's going to start. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a huge organizational type of thing.
Yeah.
But it's a recognition that, like you said earlier, we can, we're more likely to see things happening when we're doing them together rather than individually.
Yeah. Well, one of the areas that you've been focusing on a lot lately, you're currently working on, is a phenomenon that's especially impactful to Canada, which is MAID. Yep. And I wondered if you could talk to our ministry leaders about that. What is it, and why should it matter to ministry leaders?
So you want the podcast to be 4 hours long, do you?
succinctly.
MAID, medical assistance in dying. I guess kind of the quick recount. Most listening will probably be aware of this. 2016 is when medical assistance in dying was legalized in Canada. Perhaps to jump really fast forward to this is that we're certainly not the first country in the world to have legalized euthanasia and assisted suicide.
Yeah.
Certainly in the United States, there is precedence. Long before that, there was European countries like the Netherlands who've long been practicing euthanasia and assisted suicide. The strange part of this narrative is that Canada, although Canada only legalized it in 2016, we've leapfrogged over all of other nations in the world and have become the world leader in euthanasia. That's not particularly something that I feel like we should be proud of. And so you take a look at the stats. In 2022 we had about 14,000 people who elected to have medical assistance in dying to be euthanized. Of those nearly 14,000 people, about 99.9% chose euthanasia. Of course, euthanasia is, sort of more the passive. It's a consent for a medical professional to end one's life, whereas assisted suicide is being given a mechanism and a pharmaceutical of some sort to be able to end one's life with one's own hand under medical supervision. And so it is sobering to think that in Canada, out of the 14,000 people who've elected this, 99.9% have chosen euthanasia over assisted suicide.
Yeah.
Which those contrasts are pretty important because mm-hmm. in contexts like in California where assisted suicide is legalized, the numbers are significantly lower.
Hmm.
Even though the overall population of California, for example,
similar.
Is about similar to the population of Canada.
Yeah.
And in California, they only had, don't quote me on these numbers, I'm saying it on a podcast
generally,
here.
Yeah,
but we're talking about in the hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
And in Canada, we have 14,000.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So something is qualitatively different.
What's in the water in Canada right now?
Yeah, yeah. Something's different going on here. So at the EFC, I've certainly been involved in these debates way back into even before this was legalized. I was involved mm-hmm. in a couple court cases in Ontario, gave some affidavits from an evangelical perspective on conscience issues and euthanasia. But I think culturally, what we're seeing is the outworking of the philosophy that I am the Lord and master of my own life.
Mm.
Which has been extended to Lord and Master over my own death.
Right. Yeah.
And so personal autonomy.
Yeah. High individualism.
The gold standard of our ethical decision making in Canada, which is consent.
Yeah.
You know, consent is the golden standard.
As long as you're okay with it, yeah.
As long as you choose it, you're it's acceptable.
Yeah.
And that has led to this really epidemic of people choosing to end their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but that's all really complexified by factors like the inability to get palliative care. The medical shortages of care for people who are diagnosed with various ailments who can't get the help.
Right.
So that's really complexified it as well. And so we have a cultural crisis where we have determined that the most important thing is to be Lord and Master of our own destinies.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the Hollywood message, right?
That's
the message of virtually everything that we hear in Hollywood is you're in charge of your own destiny. Mm. But it runs completely contrary to the biblical witnesses, you know, that Paul says in 1 Corinthians, your bodies are not your own.
Right.
You were bought with a price. Now honor God with your bodies. Mm. It's not up to us to make those choices.
So if a ministry leader is listening right now and they're thinking, well, I know it's an important cultural issue and it's kind of a political issue, but really, shouldn't we as pastors really just be about evangelism, winning souls to get them ready for eternity? How would you respond to that?
I put it this way. The gospel isn't just for the people who are saved, right? The gospel, if the gospel is encapsulated in what Jesus says, that the gospel is about loving God and loving our neighbors, right? That means the outworking of the gospel by Christians means that we should be living this out in such a way that we recognize that even if people don't agree with us in terms of our perspectives on the nature of who Jesus is and our need for salvation and that we're sinners and so on, we should be living out the gospel, loving our neighbors in such a way that we're saying, even though you disagree about this, God's ways are good for everyone.
Hmm. Yeah.
They're good for us all. The gospel is good for us all. There is no such thing as just like winning souls, right?
Wait a minute. You're not a Neoplatonist?
No, yeah. Even in terms of like when Christians talk about I've heard, often people say, well, what, Christians shouldn't be really imposing their morality upon others.
And that's maybe a reaction to the moral majority, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But my response is that everybody always has somebody else's moral opinion imposed upon them. Every single one of us has imposition upon us. The entire legal, code of a country is based upon moral decisions about what is right and wrong.
Yeah.
And so if something is deemed to be legal, it is a fallacy to say just because something's legal, it's moral.
That's right. Yeah.
But broadly, culturally, the loss, the legal system is actually an arbitrated, you know, someone arbitrates this, mm-hmm. the courts and the mm-hmm. parliament and the House of Commons arbitrate and say this, you know, culturally, societally, we're going to say this is an acceptable thing and this is an unacceptable thing.
Right.
Yeah. So morality is always imposed. It's yeah. always imposed by someone upon from somewhere to all of us. We all help.
Yeah.
So you know, when we consider that in, you know, 2015 or in early 2016, the cultural expectation was that nobody should be going around and helping other people commit suicide, and then overnight at the stroke of a pen, suddenly this is acceptable.
Right.
Is an imposition of a moral standard. It's a moral conviction. So when we as Christians are talking about these issues, we're talking about them not just because we want to impose our moral standards upon others, but because we actually think that the preservation of life is honoring to God, whether you're a Christian or not, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're in a representative democracy. Why would we not be part of that representation in
speaking
to
that.
Issues,
certainly,
right?
Certainly like that. But even I think even beyond the representation is good witness is good witness, whether anyone hears it or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Whether anyone hears it or not.
Yeah.
And so one of the reasons, a lot of people perhaps are unaware that even the processes of how public policy influence kind
right.
of works,
right.
and legal and public policy influence works. For example, with the EFC, we've been on, you know, well over 30 Supreme Court interventions on various cases of religious liberty, sanctity of life, and so on. And what people don't realize is that these interventions, these submissions into the law system become a matter of public witness, they mm-hmm. become a matter of public record.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so even if a case goes in a different direction that we would hope for, those affidavits, those testimonies remain a permanent part of Canada's legal history.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And someone researching down the road might be reading some of these opinions and start tracking the arguments that are taking place, and someday might say, whoa, the train has gone off the tracks here somewhere along the way.
Especially,
and they were arguing against this, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and nobody listened. Maybe we need to listen to this argument.
And isn't our Supreme Court decisions often based on precedent?
Always.
Right?
There's always precedent.
So that's a significant factor
in these final decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, public policy advocacy is at, you know, certainly one part, like you say, is we are still part of a democratic society, a free and democratic society, and that means that we do have the freedom to voice a witness mm-hmm. to what we think is the best way to live the common life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's as simple as saying, we just simply think it's the best thing for society not to be ending the lives of the most vulnerable.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really where it comes down. I think that's really where the issue is right now, is that our concerns about MAID are not just merely moral, although they certainly are moral. They're certainly, we do believe that it's wrong to take a human life without some kind of divine permission, and we won't get way off onto those issues.
Yeah.
But it's not only just that. It's that when we're talking about these issues, they're representing a vision for a good society, a good culture,
a good
world in which to live with.
Yeah.
And our biggest concerns is that a lot of the direction and the actual practices of the way MAID has been going is it's actually affecting more and more people, marginalized peoples. Mm-hmm. It's
right.
affecting people who are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And we're hearing, you know, story after story of people who have some kind of illness that the public system is failing to address, or because they have these illnesses, for example, they're unable to work, and therefore they're unable to find housing.
So there's a certain people that are going to be targeted.
There's a whole spiral. Yeah, there's a whole spiral of things.
Which
they,
is,
they're sick, they're chronically ill, they can't work, so they can't work, so they can't make money, so they can't pay their bills, so they can't keep a house, so they become homeless. And eventually those kind of spirals, they are real spirals where that person says, I don't have any hope left.
Right. Yeah.
I have no more hope left. And so rather than being a burden on a family, rather than being a burden on society, I've got this illness, might as well just take me.
Yeah.
And is that really how we want to treat people in society?
No. Well, and I mean, we have a long history of Christians being involved in issues since the beginning, like the early church, infanticide, gladiatorial shows, the treatment of women. I mean, all that. I mean, go back to William Wilberforce and our involvement with this, you know, slave trade.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, that it's part of our lifeblood, and so the gospel is not to be limited.
And while you're at that, Rob, can I just interject something? Coming back to earlier to our conversation, that's part of our deep history of the evangelical movement.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
You go back into the evangelical movement, it wasn't just about saving souls. It's what do we do with people after their souls are saved? What kind of lives are they going to live? Are they going to be educated? Are they going to be taken care of in terms of their employment and their health and their labor and their families? Those are all part of the outworkings
and
of the
gospel. Much more holistic understanding of the outworkings of the gospel. I wonder sometimes if the result of the modernist controversy, the fundamentalist modernist controversy, still lives on a little bit today, where we create this divide between evangelism and, say, social justice, social good, and whatnot. And we're like, well, that social gospel, that's really a mainline thing. That's not really an evangelical thing. We're all about preaching the good news and evangelism.
Yeah.
I mean, and then in there, you get some theological other things that say, you know, what does it matter about this life? You know, we're all going to, the world's going to burn and all that. But all of this kind of gets mixed up into the evangelical movement, and so there's this posture within churches is like, no, that we don't. A soldier doesn't get involved in civilian affairs, just soldier on in the gospel, but ignore all these things. And I'm seeing now, particularly with emerging generations, a movement towards the middle on both of these things, and saying that we need a much more holistic understanding of the gospel.
It's interesting you raise that because. Again, we were talking about how, you know, there is a sense in which there's a particular kind of understanding of evangelical in a North American context, Western context.
Yeah, yeah.
And something that we could all benefit from is turning our eyes globally to the global movement. And so, you know, I've had you know, a degree of privilege to be in various international contexts, even in the last few years, and in particular this past year. But to be recognizing that when I talk to evangelical leaders within the developing world, they look at me cross-eyed if I were ever to say to them, do you believe that the gospel is about preaching or about demonstration? And they don't even understand that dichotomy. To them, it's why would you ask such a silly question?
Yes.
Right? And it's not because the answer is so obvious one way or the other. It's that they understand that the gospel is loving God and loving your neighbor.
Right. Yeah.
And it's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're actually people who've been redeemed by the gospel of Jesus, it's just a given that we're going to care for one another.
Yeah.
We're going to take care of each other. We're going to manifest that in the most, you know, practical and physical kinds of ways.
Yeah.
And if we see someone hungry, we're going to try and feed them.
Yeah. You know?
Regardless of whether they're a Christian or not.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, let's talk about the implications of this then. I think it's not enough to just win a political battle about this. There are people with real needs,
right?
And so I think it's akin to the abortion issue. It's enough for, you know, people to get up and say abortion's wrong and, you know, and fight it. But what about all of the unwed mothers with children and the orphans, and what do we do with that? Whereas I saw we're seeing within the evangelical world a movement towards adoption and a movement towards helping single moms and whatnot, rather than just wagging our fingers. Yep. And I think the implications of this, then, if this really matters, if we truly believe this matters, then that's going to mean implications for churches.
Absolutely.
So what does that mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Can I appeal to the parable of the Good Samaritan, mm-hmm. which has become tremendously important to me in my reflections on this whole area of how we show compassion to people. Mm-hmm. When we think about compassion, we've tended to interiorize compassion as if it's kind of a movement of the heart, or it's a kind of an emotional response,
right?
And as Jesus is telling the story of the good Samaritan, you know, we see this man who's beaten up, and the text actually literally says he was half dead, mm-hmm. demithamatos, he was half dead.
Yeah, yeah.
And if there's ever a candidate for maid in the Bible, it's this guy.
Yeah,
like
absolutely,
he's half dead. And then the Samaritan comes along, and what does he do? He stops. He interrupts his trip. He interrupts his agenda. He takes his own resources, the oil and the bandages. Mm-hmm. He puts them on his cart or horse or donkey or whatever, and he takes him to the inn. He lays down a couple denarii. He says to the innkeeper, take care of the guy. If there's anything more owing, I'm going to come back and check on him. Now, the Samaritan is commended because he showed mercy. He mm-hmm. showed compassion. And I think that is speaks so, you know, vitally to the church. And we have to realize that it's one thing to win a political battle or a legal battle.
Yeah.
It's quite another to truly show compassion like the Samaritan showed.
Right. Outworking.
And that means, mm-hmm. I put it in these terms, if we want a term that really tells us what compassion is, it's inconvenience.
Yeah.
It interferes with my timeline.
Mm-hmm.
It interferes with my finances. It interferes with my agenda. It interferes with my comfort.
Yeah.
And so there's a level of that we're called to. This kind of gospel response mm-hmm. to these needs is going to be really, really inconvenient.
Yeah.
It's going to cost us. It's going to be painful. It's not even going to be fun.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is the call of compassion.
Yeah.
Not just, I feel sorry for you. James speaks of that, right?
Yeah.
He says, what good is it if, you know, you say, you see someone in need and you say, go in peace and enjoy your day.
Yeah.
Right. And not give them anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this is the challenges that I think we're going to face on this issue in particular. Continued facing with abortion.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. It's one thing to say we need a law that deals with abortion. And I say, amen, we do need a law. We do need legal protections for the unborn. But we also have to address the question, what do we do if we were to get that law today and all mm-hmm. abortion ceased? Next year, there's going to be 100,000 unwanted children. And
that's
who's
right.
going to take them in?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so slacktivism is not enough, right?
No, that's
it's
right.
not enough to post about it or tweet about it or put a you know, something on your Instagram account on an appropriate day because of a cause. It requires boots on the ground. It requires a radical reorientation of your life around the gospel.
That's right.
Yep. You know, I was just rereading today Rodney Stark's book, The Rise of Christianity.
Right.
I don't know if you've read it, but there's some things in it that perhaps are contestable, but he asks the question, he predicts that the church rose from 120 initial followers to something like 33 million followers by 350 AD. That mm-hmm. Constantine was actually following the wake of what was happening in the Roman Empire. And whether that number is accurate or not, it may have been less, it probably was. Yeah, you know, but he said it's probably 56% of the empire might have been actually. But he poses the question: what was it? What was this one of the significant factors that caused such a rapid increase of the church, 40% per year? What would have caused that? And his thesis is it was the way that Christians responded to the plague.
Right. Yeah.
That. I mean, the empire had no answer for it. Bodies were being piled up in temples. The houses burnt to the ground. Bodies shipped out of the city in wagons. But the only people who actually compassionately cared for all of the people who were surviving plagues, risked their lives to do it.
Yeah.
Were Christians.
Yeah.
These marginalized, poor, you know,
well, everyone was
mistreated
running out
people.
Of the city. They were running in.
They were running in. Yep. And I just think today, what would it be like for us to reclaim some of these social services away from the government mm-hmm. and back into our own hands, and to say, okay, no, we want to truly be the people of God
right.
on mission in the world, not to win, you know, not to change the politique. but just because we should do that. It's just the right thing to do. It's what it means to be representatives of the kingdom and to give people a foretaste of the kingdom that is to come.
And certainly back to an earlier part of our conversation, far too often we've pushed these issues at too high of a public policy level. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so while MAID, for example, public policy legally adopted from a federal level, the effects of it are all provincially regulated. So there's a provincial level.
Yeah.
But the addressing of it, the addressing of the fact that there's a lack of palliative care, a lack of care for those who are dying, and so on, actually goes much closer to the city and local level. Right. Yeah. So sometimes we want the solution. The solution was caused at a federal public policy level. Mm-hmm. But federal public policy doesn't always solve the problem.
No.
Right.
Governments are not always efficient.
There's a principle of in many political theory about subsidiarity.
Yeah.
Which means that you push down towards the lowest possible level of authority to deal with the problem. Hmm. You know, the farther up you send it up the chain, the less likely you're actually to see like social change within the context, right? You don't write your MP to get the pothole in front of your house fixed.
Yeah.
Right? That's a wasted energy. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Right? But so you contact your councilman.
Yeah.
Right? Or your councilwoman. And they're the ones who can actually deal with the problem because they're closest to it. And so that's why I am actually arguing that it is pretty important for the churches to start thinking about a lot of these issues that we're dealing, even the social issues. I mean, we can complain about, the lack of federal legislation or provincial legislation. But even if you have those legislation, it still doesn't necessarily solve the problem on the ground.
That's right. Yeah, the government's not going to solve all of our problems. Yeah. And, they're in terms of missiology terms, we often use the phrase is that innovation never happens at the centers of ecclesial authority.
Right.
It always happens at the fringes or the margins.
Right. That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's true of all things. All great new innovations happen, somebody out there doing something. And I think, if our ministry leaders could just thoughtfully and prayerfully think through, what could we do at the ground, boots on the ground level in our communities? Well, our time is running out here. I wondered if you might give a final word of encouragement to our ministry leaders who are out there.
Right. Wow, that's a tough one. I think somewhat unrelated really to everything that we've been talking about is never forget your baptism and never forget your calling.
Hmm.
Right? Hmm. Never forget your baptism. Remember who your allegiance is, who your primary allegiance is. Because there's all kinds of allegiances pulling at you. And it includes your denominational structures and your bosses and so on. Those are all good allegiances, but ultimately, our baptism is our ultimate allegiance. And we have to say, I'm baptized into the name of the Lord, into the triune God. Therein, lies my ultimate allegiance. Hmm. And then our calling. Most ministry leaders, I'm pretty sure, have a narrative. And that narrative of calling, certainly for me it has been, is review that narrative once in a while. Remember what it was that caught your attention when the Holy Spirit first tapped on your shoulder and says, I want you, and this is what I want you to do. And it's not going to be easy, especially when you're going through difficult times or challenging times. And calling doesn't necessarily mean that trajectories don't change or we change ministries. I'm not saying that there's never such of those things. Mm. But even on those crisis points, when we're maybe having a crisis of ministry calling and ministry where we're at right now, pause, remember, who am I serving?
Yeah.
Who ultimately do I have to serve in this decision? And then, why did God originally call me? And am I still living that out? Hmm. Or maybe the context has changed in such that I'm not able to live that out, and that's okay. That's okay. But don't neglect that calling. So I think that's somewhat a little bit unrelated, maybe to everything.
No,
but it's the thing that
it's the center.
That's been kind of on my heart. So
yeah. Good word. This has been Rich.
David, thanks, Rob.
Yeah, David Gretzky. Yeah. Thanks for joining us on Church in the North.
Thank you.
Hope God to get bless. You back again.
Yeah. Take care.
Church in the North is a production of Briarcrest College. For more information about the podcast, visit churchinthenorth.ca. To
To learn more about Briarcrest, visit briarcrest.ca. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard today, please leave us a review and share this episode with other ministry leaders.